This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. They were stunning ideas, really, given the times, that the family and religion would decline and disappear, that two main classes, workers and capitalists, were heading for a historic worldwide showdown, and that the workers would win, that the danger and tension in modern society was fueled by the relationship of industrial workers to the things they made, that the determining force in modern life was economics. Karl Marx died long before the political and economic ideas he pioneered had worldwide impact. He was a 19th century intellectual who cast an enormous shadow across the 20th century. Though Marx himself thought his economic prescriptions would first take hold in the most advanced industrial societies, Marxism became a driving force in places still taking their first steps out of feudalism. Russia, China, large swaths of Asia and Africa, and on university campuses everywhere. Marx said the state would eventually atrophy, while leaders who called themselves Marxists built some of the most pervasive states in history. While the world's poor found themselves living in Marxist states, modern capitalism made Marx's proletarians, the people who were supposed to be the vanguards of the revolution in the West, anything but revolutionary. Eventually, Marxism lost its sway over vast chunks of the world's territory and the vast number of the world's people. The joke now is that eventually the world's final Marxists will be found on American campuses. Whatever today's political fashions advise us about the popularity or attraction of ideas, shouldn't we continue to read Marx? After the fall of the Soviet Union, the slow disappearance of May Day parades, shouldn't we still study the work of a man who's had such enormous influence on this unhappy century? What, if anything, does Karl Marx, social theorist, economist, philosopher, have to say to us today? Joining us this fine May Day to talk with you about Marx's legacy to a post-Marxist world are Douglas Kellner, professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Ray. Happy to be here.
And Francis Fox Piven, distinguished professor of political science and sociology at the City University of New York. Good to have you with us.
Glad to talk with you.
Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Well, during the 80s, there was a lot of delight about saying that Marxist ideas, in the words of Ronald Reagan, would end up on the scrap heap of history or the dust heap of history. A lot's changed since then, but does Marx still matter? Professor Piven?
Oh, I think Marx matters very much. Marx was one of the three, four, five great thinkers of the 19th century who helped to explain the kind of society that was emerging, an industrial society, a capitalist society, and an urban society. And his theoretical scheme and political commentaries not only affected workers, as you suggest, or affected an impoverished rural population in China, Russia, they had an enormous effect on all Western thought in the 19th and 20th century. There is no one who writes importantly about Western society, Western politics, who is not directly or indirectly influenced by Marxism, by its theory of history, by its predictions, and of course by its rippled effect in the real world of politics. Marx matters, and I think he matters in another sense too, that while aspects of Marx's predictions for the future were not realized, aspects were realized. And I think in a way that is quite chilling today. There's a sense in which those two great classes, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, the proletariat and the capitalists, are again emerging to be important forces in history, and especially international capitalism is emerging to be an important force. So while Marx is like everyone else in the sense that he did not predict the future, who did? There are important senses in which we can still learn from Marx, and everyone is still responsive to his arguments.
Douglas Kellner, maybe this is time to have a more a la carte approach to Marx. Read for some interest, for some guidance, those things that he was unquestionably wrong about. But read in the search for a matrix to place on the world, some of his social theory, which gives you provocative ways to think about what money is, what work is, things like that.
Absolutely. I think that Marx still provides some of the best tools for understanding contemporary society and history. We're moving into a new era of global capitalism, and I think that Marx is one of our best guides, that it's Marx that first saw that capitalism was producing an entire new society, that the bourgeoisie was creating a world in its image, that a commodity-producing society was producing new configurations of class society, and that capitalism was producing a new world economic system that was going all over the world. And this is exactly what's happening today. We're moving into a new era of transnational capitalism, where no longer is the nation state and national economies necessarily the fundamental unit of economic and political organization, but more and more transnational organizations, new forms of technology, new products and commodities are traversing the entire globe. And Marx provides the sort of global, historical, and critical theory that enables us to theorize such things as the developments of new technologies, a new transnational organization of capitalism. Still to this day, I think Marx has the deepest insights into the extent to which it is capital that is the organizing principle for society. And to understand things, you need to look at economic factors. You have to look at the intersection of capital and class, capital and technology, capital and politics. And this continues to be a powerful analytical tool or set of methods to understand the contemporary world.
You know, Francis Fox Piven, it's hard for us at this point, on the verge of the 21st century, to easily assess just how revolutionary some of these ideas were. When you read in some of the early works, insights into what profit is, for instance, what a worker is doing when he produces 500 times more shirts than he could ever wear in a lifetime. It's hard to understand just how new they were. Were there a lot of other social theorists working at the time who were dancing around some of these same ideas, or was it really Marx's great feat to set this down on paper and codify it?
Well, like all, I think, important thinkers, Marx's theory of capitalism was both new and rooted in Western thought, rooted especially in classical economics and in German philosophy. So that in some ways, Marx was a direct descendant of Ricardo. But what Marx did was he developed a kind of total or holistic view of history and society. He saw the emerging industrial capitalist society as a system, something that could be understood as essentially determined by a mode of production and in which all parts of the society were reflective of that mode of production. But the other enormous contribution of Karl Marx, and I think this is even more important, more important than simply theorizing our social experience, was the critical perspective that his theory yielded on that society. And that's what you are really talking about, Ray, when you keep asking us about profit, about the surpluses produced by the capitalist mode. Marx saw this new mode of production and the capitalist arrangements through which it was organized. He saw this as first essentially exploitative, as something that could be criticized and something that could be changed, because he also thought that the capitalist mode of production would bring into being the very forces that would topple it, namely the organized, conscious, solidary working class. In that hope, he was wrong, but not entirely wrong, because Marxism helped to nourish the labor movement of the West, particularly of Western Europe, and that labor movement in turn gave rise to working class political parties and helped to push for the more humanizing reforms of the late 19th and 20th century. So Marx is implicated not only in our understanding of our society and of history, but Marx played a very large political role in giving courage and hope to the working classes who helped to humanize our society and Western Europe.
Frances Fox Piven joins us this hour from NPR's New York Bureau, distinguished professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate School of the City University of New York, and co-author of Regulating the Poor, a vintage paperback reissued earlier this year. Douglas Kellner is with us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas, professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of Herbert Marcuse and the Crisis of Marxism. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. It's May Day. There were rallies around a statue of Karl Marx in Moscow as part of the continuing Russian presidential election campaign. And there were rallies quoting Marx in Poland as a resurgent Communist Party in that country seeks a place in the new political dispensation. Does Marx still matter in 1996? 800-989-8255. Brian's with us from Chicago. Hiya, Brian.
Hi. I guess Marx introduced class as a method of social analysis, and that's something that, whatever else people attribute to Marx, that's something that's profound in our understanding of the world. And I guess that he had an understanding of the capacity of the very rich to unduly influence even entire governments. And what I'm wondering is today, not to look back, but to look ahead, what does Marx and his analysis help us, how does it help us understand something like democracy? Not the trappings of democracy like a parliament or an election, but actually the ability of people to have an influence over the decisions that affect them.
I would like to address that issue. Marx is often blamed for the failures of Soviet communism, for the erection of a bureaucratic communist state, whereas Marx himself was a great democrat who stressed from his early to late writings the importance of democracy as an important organizing principle for politics, society, and the workplace. Marx stressed the importance of giving the workers themselves power in the factory to make decisions over how labor is organized, what products are produced, how production takes place. In Marx's late writings on the Paris Commune, he pointed to the organization of Paris, France, after the Paris Commune in the 1870s, where the workers took over all the institutions of society, had popular assemblies, democratic elections, and Marx said that that's what he meant by socialism. So for Marx, socialism and democracy were equivalent. So he continues to be an inspiration for the democratization of society. For Marx, democracy is not just voting in elections, but it's what we've come to call participatory democracy or strong democracy, in which all through society, through every institution, democratic decision making is the norm and the model. So really, the Soviet communists and communist parties all over the world downplayed that classical element of Marx, the articulation with democracy. So this is an issue that I think Marx continues to be relevant on.
But didn't he miss the essential conservatism of a lot of societies? And here's what I mean by that. There are, in some of his writings, prescriptions for a constant renewal of the political order in a society, so that forms would die out, new ones would quickly take their place, and there would be a society in a state of constant change. And
right.
I think he missed that people feel are made to feel very insecure by that very thing.
Well people are made to feel very insecure by capitalism itself. And I think that was also an observation that Marx would have shared. the constant change that undermines people, undermines their sense of having moorings, of having stability, of having tradition, is something that Marx and Engels attributed to capitalism, and I think rightly so. When people in the United States today, for example, feel insecure, they don't feel insecure because radical demagogues are urging them to take to the streets. That couldn't matter less to them.
No, they but rather, if we had a new constitution every 5 years, they might feel that way.
That's true, but they feel even... No, you're right about that, Ray, but I don't know that Marx recommended a new constitution every 5 years. What people feel most insecure about is that their way of earning a livelihood has become insecure, that they don't know that they're going to be able to earn enough to maintain themselves and their family in the way that they have been maintaining them. They don't know whether their children are going to be able to find a job in this town, or certainly they don't know if their kid is going to be able to go to college. That's why. Now, why do people feel insecure about that? It isn't because of a kind of revolutionary political ethos. It's because capitalism itself is revolutionary in the sense that it is disrupting the underpinnings of stable family and community life. And that's an observation that Marx was one of the first to make.
Brian, did we answer your question?
A little bit. You know, I also wondered, do you think when those questions are asked by everybody today that things like free market and competition, which are almost held up as gods, distract us from using something like Marx's class analysis? It seems that we're too willing to say that, well, that's the price of the free market, and the analysis never goes any further. Does Marx have anything to offer to the people who are asking those types of questions?
Well, I think...
Go ahead.
Douglas, did you want to talk to that? I was just going to say very quickly that I think Marx said two things about that issue. One was that the depredations of a capitalist, of an unbridled capitalist society, and including the ability of the dominant class to influence the very way we think, stood as obstacles to democracy. And Marx did not place a great deal of confidence. He's very ambivalent about elections, voting, and the sort of apparatus of liberal democracies as a countervailing source of influence.
Douglas and this Kilmer. Is why I think Marx continues to be relevant, because he has deep insights into how the power of the capitalist class, for instance, in politics, in culture, in social life, university life, continues to be an obstacle to democratization. For instance, in our political system, that people really don't have that much individual power and aren't able to participate in any but a secondary way in terms of elections and voting, which themselves is controlled by big money, by the business interests, by the corporate capitalist class. So Marx has deep insights into how capital has too much power, that people don't have enough.
Brian in Chicago, thanks a lot for your call. We'll move next to College Park, Maryland. Das, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ray. I am from a state in India called West Bengal, which is still ruled by a party who call themselves Marxists. And growing up in West Bengal, we got to hear some Marxist quotations all the time, just like you would hear Bible verses. What I find interesting, every time the party or the government had a change in policy, they were able to find out some quotation of Marx saying by which they could justify their action. What I wanted to know is how much self-contradiction is there in Marx's writings, or is it just those parties were quoting out of context, or did Marx evolve and change his ideas over the course of time?
There's so many different versions of Marxism that there's the possibility of extracting any number of different doctrines and theories. For instance, I would make a distinction between Marxism as a critical theory of society, a set of tools to analyze history and society as guidelines for social change, and as a doctrine, an ideology, a religion, as it is institutionalized in different state communist societies and different political parties. Moreover, within Marxism itself, there's certain scientific traditions, so-called critical and philosophical traditions, as well as all the different political differences between Trotskyists and Leninists and more radical democratic Marxists. So one can find a tremendous amount of ideas within the Marxian tradition that can legitimate various types of political practice and theoretical positions. Marx, I think, was such a great intellectual because he synthesized so many different ideas from British political economy, from French Enlightenment and revolutionary thought, from German idealism and materialism. So there was just a tremendous wealth of ideas in Marx's thought. And as you pointed out, or as you questioned, yes, he did develop very much over the years. He worked hours every day in his theoretical and empirical studies and was constantly developing, refining, strengthening his ideas. So that's why there's so many different positions on Marx all over the world, is just because of the richness and complexity of his thought.
And I think you both touched on the notion that a lot of things that went in the past 30 years or so under the label, capital M, Marxism, were apples falling pretty far from the tree. Some of them had nothing to do with Marx, per se.
And, you know, any political movement is able to grab quotations from any great thinker. If you think about the way in which the words of Thomas Jefferson have been abused by politicians in the United States, for example, you get some idea of the great distance that can exist between the arduous work of the original philosopher and the political abuses of that work.
But it's interesting to watch Eastern Europe as some unreformed communists continue to embrace what they think Marx is, while social democrats, who might very profitably use Marx as a touchstone, are keeping big distance between him because he has bad associations of an old way of life that they want to get rid of.
That's part of it, and part of it also is just the strength and intimidating effect of propaganda against Marx and the Marxist intellectual tradition. It hasn't emerged from the class wars of the 19th and 20th century unscathed by any means.
Well, we're going to be taking a break in just a moment. Douglas Kellner is joining us from Austin, Texas. Francis Fox Piven from NPR's Bureau in New York. And on this May Day, we're discussing the work, the life, the legacy of Karl Marx, a man much celebrated and paraded around the public squares of the Marxist world, usually on May Day. That is a celebration and a form of celebration that has much declined in recent decades. We'll talk about the whys and whats and wherefores of this interesting man and his career and his continuing relevance into, well, what's about to be the 21st century. To contact us here at Talk of the Nation, you can send us email at totn@npr.org or regular mail. Our address there is Talk of the Nation Letters, NPR News, 635 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. And you can call us to join the conversation at 800-989-8255. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about Karl Marx this hour. My guests are Douglas Kellner, a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin, and Francis Fox Piven, distinguished professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate School of the City University of New York. To join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255 or join the parallel chat online on America Online. You can log in, search for the keyword NPR, and click on the Talk of the Nation icon. You'll find other people who want to talk with you, well, over the keyboard, about Karl Marx. Linda joins us from Berkeley, California. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Should I go right ahead with my question?
Go right ahead, Linda.
Okay. Well, briefly, the problem I want to present is, you know, working in an academic setting like you, I've been having the experience that Marxist influence is so huge that Marxist and kind of post-Marxian thought, economics and power, have become just irresistibly central to all conversations. So that they've colonized all the fields in the humanities. so that as somebody who works on culture, you know, as on religion and literature in my case, I'm expected to know a lot about Marx and a huge body of post-Marxian thought to understand economics and class and capitalism and global systems and a lot of other things that I don't understand very well in order to talk about culture. But nobody asks you, political scientists or economics, to know about religion and literature. Why is that? Or do you think that's a correct perception?
Well, I think that political scientists should know about religion and literature. They should know about culture because culture very much affects politics. It affects what people think is possible through politics, how they go about organizing for political action, and so forth. And with that same orientation, I think that it's a good thing that people who are working in the area of religion and culture, working in the area of religion and literature, are urged to know about Marxian thought. After all, Marxism, 19th century Marxism, did spur the development of a series of investigations into culture and the relationship of structural conditions to culture, to what people thought about the world, that was an enormous contribution to our understanding of how people think or why people think the way they think. I urge you to be patient. As for the notion that Marxism has exclusively colonized cultural studies, I think that doesn't match my experience at all. No. I think, in fact, that the series of postmodern investigators, philosophers, critics, whatever, have, and this is a characteristic of the academic world, one fashion sweeps aside another fashion, have overtaken Marxism and have at least momentarily established their domination with some good effects and some bad effects. I don't think academic work should be like the seasons. We shouldn't change clothes.
You know, Linda, I was sitting here grinning as you were describing your predicament because I took a literary theory class in a 19th century American literature at that great bastion of Marxism, the University of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And basically, Marx was the seminal text.
Right.
The works of a German expatriate working in Britain became sort of the philosopher's stone by which you, the Rosetta Stone by which you could interpret what was going on in Whitman and in France, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and all kinds of other texts from the late 19th and early 20th century. I learned a lot of Marx studying American literature, I'll tell you.
But was the idea to see class in American literature?
Marx is a great sociological and historical thinker who argues that we need to contextualize anything, whether it's a literary text or religion or television or politics or whatever, in the socio-historical context in which whatever artifact arose. So Marx provides a historical and sociological analysis that forces you to think contextually and historically. Now, at its best, Marxism sees that culture, religion, politics, the law have a relative autonomy and have to be interpreted in interaction with these other sociological forces. So if you're really following Marx's methodological insights, you can't ignore culture or law or politics if you're doing, or philosophy for that matter, if you're doing Marxist investigation. It's true that some Marxists tend to be overly economistic in terms of reducing everything to economics or reducing everything to a narrow notion of politics. But this goes against the methodological and dialectical spirit of Marx. And I also agree with Francis that I see the university as part of the cultural wars today that have been going on through every sector of American society, from radio and television to the political sphere to the university, where Marxism has been a big influence, but it's also been heavily contested. So I see a lot of struggle and argument going on in the university about which methods are the most useful and which are the most harmful, et cetera.
Linda in Berkeley, thanks a lot for your call. We'll move on to Jersey City, New Jersey. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Ray, very interesting show. I wanted to make a point about Marx's point about the self-destructive nature of capitalism. As far as I can tell, two of his predictions are coming true right now. And one is that technology would gradually replace ordinary human labor in the labor force, which is happening apace. It happened first in the industrial section and now among people who work in corporate jobs. And the second point that he made was that capital, in addition to this substitution of technology, that capital, both in the sense of money to buy physical plant for production and the plant itself, are becoming consolidated in the hands of a very few people. I think anyone who's a state socialist, which I'm not, would be gratified by these two developments, especially the second, the concentration of capital, because that makes power, just economic power, that much more easily for the state to seize. For examples of these consolidations, I would look at, you can see them in the communications industry, you can see them in the retail sector, with Walmart wiping out small mom and pop stores.
But Lewis, let's say we were to take that analysis, which I think is very sound and well thought out, and try to marry that with the notion that tens of millions of workers have their retirement money and their life savings now sitting in mutual funds, which represent the equity of hundreds of American corporations. Aren't the proletarians capitalists?
Well,
that degree?
That's true, and that's one of the reasons that people forget that Marx, rather than Keynes, originated the idea of a self-destructive capitalism. Of course, Marx missed a lot of things, and Marxism is a religion. For people who are very oppressed, what we have succeeded very well in doing is exploiting the worst excesses of capitalism overseas, so that my L.L. Bean clothing, for instance, might be made by a woman in Bangladesh who's being paid $30 a month and working at 10 or 11
hours a day. This is hurting the American working class.
I'm sorry?
Because there's this corporate downsizing, this deindustrialization, technology replacing jobs. So really, the working class has had a tremendous decline in its standard of living, its class its life expectations. Class differences between rich and poor are growing. So whereas on one hand, after World War II, there was a short period, relatively short from historical perspective, of affluence, where the working class was having a greater standard of living, greater security, becoming integrated into the system. Now the working class is in a much worse position than it has been for decades, so that class, I think, matters. It's a more salient category for the organization of society, and Marx provides insight into this.
Yeah, I'd just like to close out my comment, if I can, by saying that, I think that as long as the deficiencies and excesses of capitalism, whether it's the pure market kind that only exists in the fantasy of economists and the propped up variety which we have now, where government intervenes so much to protect the capitalist system, that as long as this system has excesses and deficiencies, for just so long there's going to be a market for Marx's ideas. And I think I'll just get off the line and make room for other callers, if you don't mind.
Lewis, thanks for your call.
Sure, bye.
Francis Fox Piven, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say that we sort of skipped over your comment on pension funds, because it is true that in principle, the working class does control huge concentrations of finance capital and could be a large influence in markets. And maybe someday it will develop the wherewithal to do that. But so far, it hasn't. There hasn't been the organization of the pension funds, the allocation of control over the pension funds is one problem. The other problem has to do with developing the degree of solidarity and consciousness among workers, which would permit them to want to use their pension funds not just to protect their own pension and enlarge their own individual pension, but to become a force in economic planning and creating the economic future. It's been very, very, it's been a hope that's been around in some quarters for some time, but very little has come of it.
Yeah, it's power that admittedly hasn't been
used. Yeah.
But it also is very contradictory to what Marx predicted about the diverging interests of the two classes, the inevitable two classes.
Well, there are other contradictions, too, because certainly in any short run, workers have a great stake, a great interest in the prosperity of capitalism, that the prosperity, for example, the American economy has to flourish in order for workers to do well. Maybe in some imagined long run, workers can do well if the American economy declines, if they seize power, blah, blah, blah. No real workers are willing to shelve their own life prospects for that kind of millenarian hope. So workers have a stake in making business successful. Workers have a stake in having national capitals thrive. At the same time, of course, workers are also simultaneously pitted against businesses that are trying to increase profits at the expense of wages and working conditions.
Let's go next to Germantown, Maryland. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great program.
Thanks.
I'm a letter carrier. I work for the post office, and I'm also a part-time social theorist. I love reading, and I guess secondary, I'm a Marxist. And the point I want to make is that too often people, let's say from the ordinary working person, dismisses any ideas, particularly Marxism, as, well, it doesn't work because it's not pure. In other words, because it failed at some level, therefore it has to be immediately dismissed. And what struck me about hearing these kinds of arguments over and over is that today's Washington Post, Robert Samuelson, who's a pretty conservative apologist for just about anything under capitalism, he has an article today titled Capitalism Under Siege, and it reminded me of the kind of critiques that the ordinary person on the street usually has for dismissing socialism or any worker ideas that might imply that it because it has a problem, therefore it has to be dismissed. My point is that they confuse a couple issues. One is when they say Marxists are economic determinists, they're forgetting the distinction between Marx is a macro theorist, like your guest said, it's important to synthesize all aspects of culture, because that's what Marxist dialectics is about. But the reason they focus on economics, particularly capitalism, is because of the alienation of capital. In other words, because it takes so much focus on our day-to-day life, and particularly as a postal worker, privatization's coming in, and they're coming in with the attempt to circle around the unions by going over and subcontracting out our work. So therefore, already we're focused on the need to deal with our insecurity, you know, the anxious workers that everybody's talking about. So all I'm saying is that ideas aren't just necessarily Marxists. They can be, in other words, some of the best capitalists in the Wall Streets are, I would consider Marxists, because they actually make some very good Marxist arguments.
Well, Nelson Rockefeller used to walk around the oil fields of Mexico with a copy of Das Kapital in his pocket, because he thought Marx had the best insights into how capital is accumulated, how profit is extracted from the workers, and that the capitalists themselves could learn from it. But to me, the issue that the caller just raised is, will capital continue to be able to deliver the goods to provide good jobs, a high standard of living, a bright future for the working class? The tendency, it seems, over the past years is, one, technology, automation, robotization is eliminating a lot of jobs. Corporate downsizing in the interests of higher profits is eliminating a lot of jobs. And deindustrialization, moving manufacturing to the third world, where there can be higher profits from lower wages, less regulation, et cetera. All of these are eliminating jobs. The postal worker just indicated the dangers of privatization. This is happening in every sector of society. So this raises real questions about whether individuals, the working class's standard of living is going to continue to go up, and whether capital is going to continue to deliver the goods or not, or, as Marx predicted, there will be a crisis.
But, you know, there's no, we've learned since Marx's time that there is no direct and automatic relationship between economic crisis and the political mobilization of the working class, or certainly not between crisis and a progressive political mobilization of the working class. Much depends on political conditions, on leadership, on culture, on opportunity created by a political system. The dangerous thing about the situation in the United States today is that, yeah, Doug, you're right, that things are getting worse for probably three-quarters of the working people in the United States. Their hourly wages are shrinking. Their jobs have become more insecure. They're working longer in order to try to just stay afloat, to try to maintain their standard of living. And they're very, very scared about what the future will hold. But there's no guarantee by any means that this is going to fuel a revolutionary movement or even indeed a reform movement. That very much depends on the political alternatives that are made available by the party system, by social movements. And the frightening thing about recent American politics is how much that anxiety has been, and it's a very widespread anxiety about economic conditions, has been directed into a kind of hate politics against immigrants, against blacks, into a kind of irrational preoccupation with the crime issue, even though crime rates are going down, and into a kind of scapegoating of welfare mothers. All of this seems to be happening at the very moment when we might have hoped that because capitalism isn't delivering the goods, people would turn toward more constructive alternatives.
But in Marx's idea of class, though,
one of the curious things that's going on in the current political system is the extent to which the right wing is assuming what would have been described as a revolutionary stance in the 1960s. In other words, I'm talking about the militia movements, the survivalist movements. Even Pat Buchanan was engaging in some quite extreme anti-corporate rhetoric, and you hear anti-corporate as well as anti-statist rhetoric in the militias and the ultra-right. But they are directing their legitimate anger and frustration and fears into violent and dangerous activities, a politics of hate, of violence, of terrorism, etc. So I completely agree with Francis that there's no guarantee that the worsening condition for the working class is going to automatically produce possibilities for a more progressive democratic politics. Indeed, quite the opposite seems to be happening. But I am struck by the extent to which an anti-corporate rhetoric is appearing in some of these right-wing groups as well as left-wing groups, that it's clearer and clearer to a lot of people that not just the state, but corporations and business are a source of their oppression. And I think this is quite a novel development within the last 10 years, say, that such anti-corporate rhetoric has emerged in so many different sectors of society.
Douglas Kellner joins us from Austin, Texas. Francis Fox Piven is at the New York Bureau. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But the both of you have just been talking as if classes are just ultimately manipulable, especially proletarians, and have no wit to discern their own self-interest, so are just being pulled like puppets on strings by forces from above. If there really was class solidarity in the way that Marx described it, they would see their interests as being able to leap across boundaries of national origin, of language, of levels of education, of levels of income. They would see that their objective circumstances are very much the same, and yet they don't.
Well, Marx created the hope that the very experience of industrial capitalism would educate working people about their own class interests and would also give them the experience that would lead to greater solidarity and target the class enemy and the bosses and so forth. That sort of scenario was in part realized in some places, but it was also extraordinarily optimistic. Indeed, it was so optimistic right. that it became a force in its own right, this incredible hope that history itself would create the class forces that would reform or revolutionize capitalism. So because it did not happen, or it only happened sometimes in some places, a great deal of work that has been done since Marx has been preoccupied with the problem of understanding what some right-wingers call ridicule as the problem of false consciousness. But of course there is a problem of false consciousness. Of course people don't typically act in their own class interests, or indeed even in their own interests. Look at the experience of women, for example. For millennia, women accepted a situation of subjugation, a commitment to service work within the family, a situation of extraordinary vulnerability and lack of social respect. And only under extraordinary conditions did women demand what might be called their gender rights instead of their class rights. So there is false consciousness. The question that is never definitively answered is this: under what conditions do working people, or indeed any subjugated group, under what conditions are they able to brush aside the clouds created, the confusion, the fog created by their lifelong experience of domination and exposure to the propaganda of those who rule them? Under what conditions are they able to overcome that and act in their own self-interest? That is perhaps the most important question in history, and it certainly is a very important question for Americans right now.
We have time for one more call. We'll go to South Texas. Loretta, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ray. Great show. Listen, I really enjoyed this and just want to let you all know there is an organization that is working and applying Marxist theory to our lives today. And one of the points that the doctor was just bringing up before I came on, I think, is very clear, that we are brought up in a society where we are bombarded daily by the capitalists and what is best for them. And it does take a great deal for us to come around and work in our own self-interest. And to do that, the International Socialists are not supporting either party, as we usually do not, because neither of these parties represent the working class. Neither one will be fulfilling any of the promises that they're putting forward, and neither of them will be working for us, the majority, once they are elected. So I would just encourage those who are interested in Marxism and applying these theories to our lives today to get involved with the International Socialists, to not support these parties, and instead to organize and work for a better future for ourselves.
Loretta, thanks. Sorry. Loretta, thanks for your call. Douglas Kellner, what do you see in the next 5-10 years with the legacy of Marx? It seems to be a very mixed picture.
Well, we definitely see culture wars, intensified class struggles, social conflict, differences emerging among various social groups as a big trend of the present moment. Karl Marx had Enlightenment optimism that individuals had the ability to see through their mystification and their manipulation, that people could organize themselves into political groups that would fight for their self-interest, that progressive social change was possible. So the question is whether this more positive Marxian scenario will take place, that different individuals, whether in new social movements, whether in political parties and alliances that are alternatives to the mainstream parties, will gain power, will organize significant amounts of people, as happened in the 1960s, where there were a significant series of social changes that took place in American society, where people did
Professor
organize
Kellner.
Themselves and struggle for change. Or whether a more negative Marxian
Professor Kellner, I'm going to have to stop
place,
it right there.
Be
thanks for being
prices,
with us. Dr. Francis Fox Piven, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone who called this hour. Douglas Kellner is a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of many books, including Critical Theory, Marxism, and Modernity. Dr. Francis Fox Piven is a distinguished professor of political science and sociology at the Graduate School of the City University of New York. She's the co-author of Regulating the Poor, The Functions of Public Welfare. Tune in tomorrow at this time as the Shirley Horn Trio joins us for a live performance. Shirley and the band will play some of the great standards and take your calls and questions. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez.